I'm going to go ahead and read the thing. On a calm but cloudy Sunday in August of 1942, beachgoers near Fort Funston on the coast of California looked up to see an odd sight. Navy blimps, often on patrol for enemy submarines, were not an uncommon sight, but what made this sighting different was the condition and course of the airship, and the fact that it was so low it was about to hit the beach. The blimp was badly bowed, almost into a V-shape, as it lifted back off from the beach, leaving a trail of sand in its wake. Onlookers watched, astonished, as it drifted into San Francisco, passing over a golf course, the south end of Lake Merced, over what is now the Daly City BART station, crossed Mission Street, and wended its way across the city before finally, almost gently, setting down on Bellevue Avenue in Daly City. Observers, neighbors, and emergency personnel rushed to the craft only to discover that its two-man crew was gone. Everything in the gondola of the craft was in perfect order, but the men had simply vanished. On this episode of Relative Disasters, the L-8 Ghost Airship. Welcome to Relative Disasters, the show where I fill a helium balloon with information, put that information into a podcast, and send it out to my sister and anyone else who feels like listening. My much cooler big sister and I manage our existential dread by talking with each other about terrible and interesting historical events, their contexts, implications, and any related sidebars that tend to distract me. My name is Greg, my sister's name is Ella, and Ella, today we're going to be talking about a combination of two of our favorite things, airships and ghost ships. Our sources for this episode include The Mystery of the L-8 by Irwin Ross in 1970 for the U.S. Naval Institute, Ghost Blimp's Enduring Mystery by Gary Kamiya for SF Gate in September of 2018. A Navy blimp took off on a routine patrol off the coast. Its crew would never be seen again by John J. Gagan for the Aviation History magazine in 2016, as well as a number of contemporary news articles and references from the Navy report on the incident. Now, Ella, I know that rigid airships are your favorites, but may I call your attention to the humble blimp? Specifically, the United States military L-class blimps. The L-class were small and used for airship training and coastal patrols. The L-8 measured just about 150 feet in length, just about the size of the famous Goodyear blimps. In fact, L-8 was a Goodyear blimp, essentially pressed into military service. The U.S. Navy had a contract with Goodyear to produce the L-class and larger K-class blimps, and the L-8 had once been a commercial Goodyear blimp before being delivered to the military when the United States entered into the Second World War. L-8 was the standout of the group. She wasn't just a training vessel, oh no. She was on coastal patrol, tracking down enemy submarines, and she played a vital role in supplying the USS Hornet on its way to launch the famous Doolittle Raiders strike on Tokyo. L-8 was a well-seasoned and reliable airship. It had made 1,092 flights before its final one, and never needed more than just its standard maintenance and repair. She packed 123,000 cubic feet of helium into her envelope in separated cells, and was powered by twin 145 horsepower engines that could get her moving at a speed of 43 knots or allow her to hover over her target, which she had done on the USS Hornet run. She was assigned to Airship Patrol Squadron 32, based off the west coast of the United States after Japan's attack on Pearl Harbor. The United States was in a heightened alert state against any attacks on the mainland, and submarine shelling runs on California and Oregon had shown that the Imperial Japanese military had that capability. The mission of Airship Patrol Squadron 32, and that of L-8, was to patrol the coast of the United States, keeping an eye out for any signs of submarines. L-8's job was to patrol about a 50-mile radius of the city of San Francisco. She was based on Treasure Island off the coast of the city. If she found any submarines, her job was to drop a Mark IV float light, a kind of almost flare bomb that sends up a large amount of smoke to mark the spot, and if need be, drop one of its two 325-pound depth charges, or open fire with its mounted .30 caliber machine gun. Imperial Japanese submarines had successfully sunk at least half a dozen Allied ships off the west coast of the United States, and L-8 was equipped to alert the Coast Guard ships to danger and engage the enemy. Now let's talk about the crew. If you were putting together a duo of American airship aces, you could do a lot worse than the team of Ernest Cody and Charles Adams. Lieutenant Junior Grade Ernest Cody was the senior aviator of Airship Patrol Squadron 32. He had been transferred to the airship branch of the Navy in late 1941, meaning that he had only had about 9 months of airship flight time before this mission. But he was described as one of the most capable pilots and officers in the squadron, a man who could keep his cool under pressure and be of sound judgment when crisis struck. He had also been rapidly promoted, achieving his current rank at the age of 27 after being the pilot who flew the USS Hornet mission. His ability to maneuver and hold the airship steady as over 300 pounds of materials were lowered to the flight deck of the aircraft carrier in choppy seas had not gone unnoticed or unrewarded. While he only had about 750 hours of lighter-than-air flight time, he was eminently capable. The other man in the gondola car for the mission was Ensign Charles Adams. He had been flying lighter-than-aircraft for over 20 years. He had served on the Los Angeles, the Akron, and the Macon. In 1938, he had even received an award from the German government for rescuing passengers from the Hindenburg crash. He knew his way around an airship, having logged over 2,200 hours of lighter-than-air flight time. He had just received his first commission at age 38, however, so this would be his first flight as an officer. The flight that they were to embark on was designated Flight 101. It was a standard patrol flight, launching from Treasure Island, then heading out west to the Farallon Islands, turning north to Point Reyes, south to Montara Beach, and then back to base at Treasure Island. They would leave at 6 a.m. and return around 10 or 10:30 in the morning. At 6:03 a.m., with Lieutenant Cody at the helm, L-8 lifted off and headed out. The sky was cloudy, but the wind wasn't too bad, and visibility was about 3 to 5 miles at operational height. As they flew out over the bay, they waved to the Navy and Coast Guard patrol boats, taking notice of the patrol craft and the fishing boats out at the time. About an hour and a half into the flight, at 7:42, Cody radioed into base. They were about 4 miles east of the Farallons and had spotted an oil slick on the water. One of the things that Coastal Patrol looked for were these oil slicks, which could sometimes be caused by lurking submarines, and each one required investigation. L-8 descended and dropped two of those floatlight flares. Nearby fishing vessels pulled in their nets and headed for shore, and the patrol boat sounded a general alarm and manned their guns, waiting for L-8 to send down a depth charge. The tension held as gunners trained their deck guns on the smoke pillars, and L-8 circled the spot. As the deck crews looked on, L-8 held at 300 feet, dropped all the way down to about 30 feet above the waters, and she never dropped a charge. To the shock of the watching patrol ships, she suddenly shot up into the sky, gaining altitude at a ferocious rate until she disappeared into the clouds. They never saw her crew again. L-8's last radio broadcast was when Cody called in to report the oil slick. There was no further communication during the investigation of the oil slick, and flight control attempted to re-establish radio contact with no success. It was not unusual for blimps to lose radio contact during a patrol. There were lots of ways that signal could be disrupted out over the waters, so flight control wasn't overly concerned, but they did want an update. When the crew still hadn't radioed in by almost 9 o'clock, they scrambled two Kingfisher float planes to fly her route and try to find the airship. A general alert also went out to the aircraft and ships to keep an eye out for her as well, in case the L-8 crew was in some distress. About 2 hours later, at nearly 11 o'clock, one of the Kingfishers reported a sighting of L-8 at almost 2,000 feet in altitude, nearly at the limit of the envelope's pressure height. If she went any higher, its valves would open and vent helium to prevent the envelope's cells from bursting. This was abnormal behavior for a patrol airship to fly so high. As the Kingfisher watched, L-8 began to descend. Her flight, to the Kingfisher pilot's eyes seemed controlled, if a little odd. For the last 2 hours, L8 had been flying between 1,500 and 2,500 feet. Given her average airspeed, it's understandable that the Kingfisher pilot, as well as a few others who spotted her during this time, assumed that she was under pilot control and heading back to base. In fact, she was floating, unmoored to crew and ungoverned by controls. There was no one on board her during that entire time. On an ocean beach in San Francisco, cleverly titled Ocean Beach, two fishermen were casting, trying to catch the midday surf. Suddenly, one shouted to another. A 150-foot blimp was falling out of the sky nearly on top of them. L8 struck the beach, kicking up a plume of sand close enough that the fishermen could grab her mooring lines. As they fought in vain to hold her down, they were able to get a clear look inside the gondola. It was empty. The wind battered L8 against the cliffside and tore her mooring lines from the men's hands. For a few moments, she was bounced like a basketball against the rock wall until one of her depth charges was jarred loose and fell to the beach. Free of the 325-pound weight, L8 took to the skies again. The Sunday morning golfers at San Francisco's exclusive Olympic Club gaped as she floated over them, heading towards the city. The loss of helium from her envelope and the weight of her gondola, as well as the earlier beach impact, gave her a noticeable bend in the middle, described by one onlooker as looking like a bent hot dog. It drifted across San Francisco, gradually and gently losing altitude, until it dropped onto Bellevue Avenue in Daly City at about 11:30 a.m. The gondola hit an electrical pole, sending a shower of sparks over the blimp and puncturing the envelope, which deflated on top of somebody's freshly waxed car. Now, Daly City Fire and Police had been chasing the blimp since it crossed city lines, and they were on the scene to record the entire drift and crash. They cut through the envelope to get to the trapped crew in the gondola and found that nobody was inside. The Navy dispatched a recovery team to take possession of the onboard depth charge and the one that had been knocked loose on Ocean Beach, and to recover the craft itself. Initial reports to flight control had stated that two men had jumped from the gondola when L8 hit Ocean Beach, mistaking the two fishermen who had attempted to grab it for the crew. By the time the gondola and what was left of the blimp had been located and salvaged, it was clear that Cody and Adams were missing. Navy intelligence and the salvage crew went over the wreckage exhaustively, and what they found was baffling. The gondola car itself was in perfect condition. Its deck was still waxed, and the parachutes and life raft were neatly stowed. Nothing was missing except for two life jackets, which regulations stated had to be worn by the crew at all times. The radio's battery was dead, but it was locked in the on position. There was no trace of moisture in the craft, no telltale seawater to show that it had touched down on the ocean somewhere or been struck by a wave. The gondola main door was fastened open, an indication that the crew had opened it for some reason. And the ignition switches were on, the engine had plenty of gas in it, even a briefcase with classified materials was still placed where it should have been, behind the pilot's seat. The pilot's hat was on the control panel. Everything was as it should be, apart from the vanished crew. The United States Navy launched a search. Patrol ships and planes retraced L8's steps across the ocean, looking for any sign of the missing men. Civilian police assisted with searching the coastline. Tons of people came forward with their own sightings or pieces of clothing that might belong to the crew. Some people claimed to have seen men in the cabin right up until the touchdown at Ocean Beach, and no clothing could be positively identified as belonging to the lost men. The Navy informed Cody and Adams' wives that they were missing. A year after the incident, they were declared legally dead. A Navy spokesman confirmed that the Navy did not believe L8 to have been attacked by an enemy ship, and that they had no idea what had happened, stating, quote, "Nothing the Navy knows now has given a satisfactory explanation of what happened," end quote. A board of investigation likewise yielded no answers. They were only able to rule things out. They did not find any evidence of a mid-air collision, a fire, submersion, officer misconduct, or death due to enemy action. The investigation shed no light on why the crew stopped using the radio, which was still working when the craft was recovered, what happened after they spotted the oil slick, and most importantly, why L8 had been abandoned by its crew. Speculation has run wild since then. The two men were captured by the Japanese sub they were trying to mark. They were both secretly spies and escaped on board the Imperial Japanese I-boat. They had a stowaway on board who was a saboteur and killed both men and dumped their bodies. The two men had decided to go AWOL and something went wrong. The two men came to blows over something and killed each other on knocking each other out of the craft. They flew too low and were hit by a rogue wave. They were testing secret military equipment that dosed both men with lethal radiation, and everything that followed was a massive cover-up. Or, of course, they were abducted by aliens. It's important to remember that the entire time they were marking the oil slick with smoke flares, the airship and its crew were in sight of the patrol ships. Any person falling from the gondola during that height would almost certainly have been spotted. L8 never really got close enough to the water to be safely abandoned so that the crew could defect or be captured. There's no evidence that any secret military equipment was being used on L8 during this flight or any other, and, as we talked about in our conspiratorial thinking episode, it's really hard to guarantee complete silence from an entire crowd of onlookers, especially when the size of the people gathered at the crash. Evidence also does not seem to suggest alien abduction. So what did happen? Well, unfortunately, we'll never know. When the Navy finished their report, they concluded that the most telling piece of evidence was the door latch on the gondola. Since it was fastened into the back position, leaving the door locked open, the safety lock may not have been properly in place during flight and may have caused the gondola door to swing open. Either of the crew that were close enough to it likely might have become unbalanced and fallen out. Alternatively, when they dropped their smoke flares, which were dropped by hand, by the way, the person doing the dropping may have lost their balance and fallen out. In any event, the pilot would have then moved to grab them without radioing for help first, because to do so would have taken up valuable seconds, and then in the attempt to save his crewmate, both men fell out. Falling nearly 300 feet would have killed both men on impact and likely destroyed enough of their life jacket materials to render them useless. It is most probable that both men died and their bodies were lost forever under the waters. Now, this is the official explanation from the Navy, and they acknowledge that it doesn't account for some of the facts, namely that nobody saw them fall and that absolutely no verifiable trace of them has ever been found. Regardless, once the men were off the ship, physics took over. Without their weight on board, L8 rose rapidly until its safety valves popped open, releasing helium and allowing it to gradually descend back down to the ground, regain altitude again after its depth charge was lost, and then resettle again. L8 was repaired and put back into service through the remainder of the war. When the war ended, she was returned to the Goodyear Company, who renamed her American. American flew the friendly skies until 1982, when she was retired. Goodyear then donated the gondola car to the Naval Aviation Museum in 2003, where it was restored to its 1942 appearance and is now on display at the museum in Pensacola, Florida. The Navy's official classification of the incident is, quote, 100% unknown / undetermined, end quote. And that's it. That's the story of the service life and its short life as a ghost ship of the airship L8. Here at Relative Disasters, we do like to fact-check our work to bring you the most accurate disasters possible. If you'd like to know more about our sources, they're cited at the beginning of the episode. Sometimes we do make mistakes, of course, so if you have any thoughts you'd like to share or corrections we need to know, please write to us at relative.disasters@gmail.com. We cannot respond to emails, but we do read each one. Or if you'd like to shame us publicly, and we know you do, why not try our Instagram, @relative.disasters. A big thank you to our listeners who give me a reason to keep doing this every week. And a big thank you to our patrons who support us on Patreon. You guys are great and help us justify keeping this podcast ad-free. And we'd like to thank our major disasters, Katie and Georgia, for their support. And this week's episode was brought to you by Beth, who has her own airship made available for gatherings and parties, and Henne, lost in 1828 as the lone pilot of the famous Ghost Tricycle, with some people still report seeing her tricycle, the Henne's Awesome, pedaling itself around neighborhoods on foggy evenings. Thank you all so much for joining us for this episode. I hope you've enjoyed the story, and I hope you'll join us again next week. Now, Ella, we've talked a lot about how corporations can get themselves in trouble when they try to do ill-thought-out promotions. Well, next week we've got not one, not two, but three stories of companies that tried to run promotions and ran headlong into regular people who did the math and took it to the bank. Next week, we've got vacuum cleaners, pudding cups, and soft drinks, all linked by airplanes and promotional giveaways in an episode I'm calling They Read the Fine Print. Have a good week, and I'll see you then.